the buzzer, McCord on its way. Oh, my goodness.
They have to get it. No timeouts. They do.
Courtside with Cats and Coach G, the definitive college basketball podcast.
South Carolina entry, 88-81. Giles fronts, 13.5. Inbound Thornwell. And they don't foul. Thornwell allowed to dribble out the clock. They waited 44 years to win a tournament game. They'll win two and knock off the two seed, Duke Blue Devils. South Carolina stuns Duke. It's on to the Sweet 16 in Greenville, 88-81.
Welcome to our Sweet 16 edition of Courtside with Cats and Coach G. That call credited to Westwood One, the NCAA Network, as South Carolina takes down Duke. By far the most surprising result of the NCAA tournament. You could argue maybe one of the most surprising results of the entire season. I'm Andy Katz, along with my co-host Seth Greenberg. Seth, let's start right there. Sunday night shocker. I was flying back from Indianapolis, so I was tracking the game during my travels. I'm sure you watched it end to end. How did it happen in your eyes?
The hardest playing toughest team finds a way to win, Andy. And I say, you know, you've heard that 1,000 times from me. And I really truly believe that South Carolina was tougher, more competitive, more alert, more locked in. So that's the first thing that just really kind of resonates with me. The second thing is Duke had no point guard. They had no leader. They played point guard by committee. When you're playing against a team as aggressive and physical defensively as South Carolina, their lack of a point guard was exposed. And finally, their inability to defend the ball on the bounce and protect the rim was also came into, you know, being a big factor in their inability to defend South Carolina. South Carolina's come back from the dead. I mean, this is a team that struggled scoring. And look what they did to Marquette and look what they did to Duke. You got to give Frank Martin a ton of credit. His team played hard. They were together. They were connected, and they played for him. It was fun to watch.
Before we move on to South Carolina's chances in the East region, let's just put a bow on Duke. I mean, this has been a bizarre season for the Blue Devils. Preseason number one, Grayson Allen, preseason player of the year. Coach K has surgery in the middle of it. He misses a bunch of games. There were injuries from a plethora of players. How would you sum up what you witnessed from Duke this season?
It was a fascinating season. I mean, from start to finish. I mean, think about right from the beginning. Harry Giles had to have surgery on his knee. You know, my big question is he came back and he wanted to come back. And obviously the coaching staff wanted to come back. I'm not sure that was the best in his best interest, big picture. But he did it and he was engaged in it. And I saw him. His interview after the game, and he was definitely invested. The injury to Tatum set him back. The issue with Grayson Allen set him back. Not having a true point guard set him back. Coach K missing to it for an extent set him back. They never developed a chemistry that you need despite the success they had in the ACC tournament. Remember, they lost 3 of their last 4 games in regular season. So they masked some of those things because they had shot-making ability and scoring ability, but this was not a typical Duke team. I said it all the time. When I played against Duke for 8 years, they drew a line in the sand every single play. They were the hardest playing, toughest team. You had to match their intensity because the second you didn't, all right, they would basically have one of those runs. This team didn't have that, and that was the difference.
The game I saw on Sunday, Michigan taking on Louisville. The Wolverines really showed their versatility over the weekend. They made 16 threes to beat Oklahoma State in a great basketball game on Friday. Just such a pleasure to watch that game. And then on Sunday, they only make 6. They commit just a handful of turnovers, and they come back on Louisville. What was your opinion of the way that game played out?
Well, it showed the versatility of and the development and maturity of Michigan. So the one game they knocked down the 3, which is who they are and how they win. And then Rick Pitino says, you're not beating us shooting the 3-ball. So we're staying home on all dribble drives and all post-ups. And in the second half, all Michigan does is play through Mo Wagner and Wilson. And Wagner was, he was terrific. He was patient. He got angles.
Great energy, by the way. Great energy.
Great energy. I thought the length of Louisville would have a greater impact, but it didn't. And then the unsung hero for this Michigan team is, to me, Billy Donlin Jr., the assistant coach that was hired in the summer, former head coach at Wright State. Michigan has lacked a defensive identity for years. Billy Donlin Jr. was brought in to give them a defensive identity, and they have developed it. And I thought they really have improved defensively. So Louisville, the Achilles heel has always been, can they make shots? Will they make shots? Will they make shots consistently? You know, I know Coach Pitino talked about the defense. I saw more of a lack of execution offensively, and then Michigan figured them out defensively.
The Gonzaga-Northwestern game over the weekend, a lot of buzz off of that one. A questionable call that the NCAA then after the fact said that they got wrong in terms of your hand being in the basket. Northwestern loses. Great comeback. No guarantee, by the way, had that call gone against the Zags that Northwestern would have been able to overtake Gonzaga and win the game, even if momentum was going in their direction. How'd you feel like that game played out, especially that call?
Yeah, it was unfortunate. You got three officials. You got the trail official who's basically in line with Chris Collins, and he misses the call. He kicked the call. I mean, that's going to happen. And you know what? When it happens in that moment in time, a coach is going to react the way Chris did. And you know what? I would have done the same thing or worse.
Yeah, you got teed up.
You know, so, I mean, it was unfortunate. Obviously, the ref would like to have that call back. Chris would like for him to have it back. You can't. It's not a reviewable mistake, error, and it makes you sick. And all parties are sick, but it's one of those things that happens in our game, and there's no guarantee that Northwestern would have won the game. But to me, it was as important as Northwestern down 22 with the resiliency to come back, fight, compete, claw, basically embrace the personality, the competitive spirit, the toughness of their head coach. That's a team that's connected with its head coach. It was fun to watch their journey.
So the Badgers knocked off the number one seed overall, Villanova. So we will have a new champion. There will not be a repeat. First time since 06-07 there was a chance of it. It's not going to happen. You know, this is a Villanova team. Let's put a bow like we did on Duke because it's the number one, top two seed, if you will. They're done, and they've had, once again, a remarkable regular season, not able to advance to the Sweet 16 after winning the national championship last season. We'll get to Wisconsin when we talk about their game here shortly. What's your sort of wrap-up on the kind of year that Villanova had?
Fabulous. I mean, no Daniel Chefu, no Ryan Arcidiacono, no Booth, no Spellman, who was a partial qualifier. The culture is so strong at Villanova. The trust is so great. The belief in the group and the good of the group for a common cause is so great. As a coach, they're fun to watch to me because everyone truly is on the same page. And for those seniors, Darryl Reynolds and Josh Hart and Chris Jenkins, their journey and what they've accomplished and the experience and the memories they have, incredible. They should not be defined by that game against a very good Wisconsin team. They should be defined by the body of work. And I thought it was just fun watching that group grow and play.
One other thing, Seth, before we get to the Sweet 16 matchups, because this is obviously creating a lot of buzz, and I'm curious your opinion because you've been a coach for three decades. You've got family, which, by the way, always behaved itself. So this picture is viral because I'm in it. Lynn Marshall, Greg Marshall's wife, she's very animated. We know that about her. Saw her last year in Providence. You know, let me just tell you what I know because there was a report that she was escorted out. I can just tell you that I saw her, you know, just cheering on Wichita State. Yes, very animatedly. But I did see her in the news conference afterward. I never saw her being escorted out. She walked by with her husband, Greg Marshall, the head coach of Wichita State, and the normal you know, person that escorts these coaches around. So I never saw her getting asked to leave. I just saw her being very animated. How do you feel about the focus on the spouses or the family and how they should or should not behave at these games?
Well, I think it's, you behave in, you know, within your own personality. I think every single person is different. Every single, you know, wife is different in terms of when their husband is doing their job, their team. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to critique someone else's wife. You know, my wife just sat there with her arms folded and didn't say a word the whole game. That's the way she was for 22 years of, as a head coach's wife. I've seen other wives deeply involved in the game and every call. And, you know, my daughters probably got up and woofed a little bit at the officials, but actually knew all of them and actually had good relationships with them, which is kind of funny. And I used to always joke, what do you talk nice about that guy? I don't like him at all, right in front of, obviously, when we'd see him together, you know, in terms of like before games. But
you know, Seth, this gets to your point about how the, you know, when a guy gets fired and things like that, when you get to this level in the NCAA tournament, how much the families are invested in every single thing that happens because it affects everyone in the family.
Oh, sure. And like, I'll give you an example. I'm looking at something right here that's in my office, Andy. It's from the USA Today. It was after we lost on that buzzer shot against North Carolina. And it was my daughter's crying, sitting in the stands. The front page of the USA Today Sports. And, you know, you live a very public life. And, you know, I don't want to judge anyone else's spouse. I love Greg Marshall. I think he's a brilliant coach. I know his family very well and have spent time with him. I just think you do have to be aware that you are a public figure and that you've got to be aware of what you say, how you say it, and who you say it to. And that's for any public figure, whether it's a coach's wife, a coach, or, you know, anyone who's in the public eye.
All right, so let's spin forward to the Sweet 16. Let's start in the East. These games are going to be in New York City. This is a Friday-Sunday regional, and this was originally supposed to be Duke-Villanova on Sunday night. That's not happening. So we've got sort of the, you know, the people at Table 19. It's a movie that's out, you know, the sort of the misfits. Wisconsin versus Florida and Baylor taking on South Carolina. Let's deal with the first one, Wisconsin-Florida. Key to the game, Seth, what do you see?
Well, I think Florida's going to try to speed up Wisconsin. Wisconsin's going to try to play at their pace. I think Nigel Hayes, to me, the key of the game is Nigel Hayes. Nigel Hayes, if he plays to his strengths and plays for the good of the group.
Which he did over the weekend.
He is an absolute brutal matchup. So I think it's Hayes' ability to play from the foul line down, short corner, short baseline, in one big box and attacking the matchup that's in his favor. I think that Wisconsin's got to take care of the ball, which what they've been doing. And lastly, in the last 3 weeks, actually since Greg was on the podcast when he said he went back to their defensive fundamentals,
mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you what's worked. They're only giving up 61 points a game since he's gone back to their defensive fundamentals. So they're back to their culture. They control the tempo of the game with their offense and their defense. They make you a jump shooting team. They limit you to one shot. They don't turn it over. I think if they stay true to their culture and Nigel Hayes plays to his strengths, I think Wisconsin wins this game.
All right, I'm going Wisconsin as well. So we're going to make a pick here each time. But I don't need to have as long an explanation as you do. You're
plus
the coach.
You can't talk.
Which
is a good thing sometimes.
I got the Seth voice a little bit here.
All right, good.
Baylor taking on South Carolina.
Hit the mute button, Josh.
Baylor, South Carolina.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is, you know, Baylor, if they can play the zone, play to 1-1-3, make South Carolina jump shooting team, obviously that's an advantage to them. If they can get to the offensive glass, that's an advantage to them. Having said that, if they don't match South Carolina's toughness, if they don't compete offensively when people are getting up and underneath them, that's going to be South Carolina's favorite. Now, I'm not sure South Carolina can score enough easy buckets, but this is going to be a very slow-paced game. I actually think South Carolina's got to speed the game up a little bit so they can get out in transition and make some plays. But my gut is South Carolina is going to find a way to win this game. I think, and not anything on destiny. I think the toughness quotient. I think Baylor's a little more talented. I think South Carolina is a little bit more determined and true to how they exactly want to compete.
All right, so who are you going with?
I'm going to go with South Carolina.
All right, I'm going Baylor.
So you don't think South Carolina is going to make any shots against the zone?
I'm just going to go Baylor.
Watch out them rebounding against that zone, Andy.
All right, so who's going to the Final Four?
I think Wisconsin. Yeah, I think Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin handles the pressure and the quickness and the strength and the toughness. I think that Hayes is very tough. I think Happ's tougher than you think. I think Vito Brown will struggle in this game. I think that Bronson Koenig will be pretty tough in this game.
All right, so we agree on that. The Badgers back to the Final Four.
There you
three
go.
Of the last
the Badgers.
Years.
And then you know what happens after that? They send you a letter asking for you to share some of that big cash you're making.
I'll tell you, that would be amazing. Three of the last 4 years. All right, let's stay on the left side of the bracket. Let's go out west. Gonzaga taking on West Virginia. These are going to be Thursday, Saturday games in San Jose. I spoke with Mark Few on Sunday, Seth, and he said if there's one team he was really worried about, it was West Virginia. It's the kind of style that could really bother them. But that's one game, and then Xavier taking on Arizona. We're going to be joined shortly by Chris Mack, the head coach of Xavier. So let's start with Gonzaga, West Virginia. How much do you share the concerns of Mark Few?
I share the concerns. Without a doubt, I share the concerns. You know, look, to press, what do you have to be up to do, Andy? Come on, this is like a quiz. You're a very smart guy. You should be able to handle this quiz.
You need ball handlers.
I'll give you the answer. To press, you've got to be able to make shots so you can get into the press.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry.
So
I thought
the
you
start
to
of the
press.
Game against Notre Dame, West Virginia scores it so they can get into pressure. That way they can own.
Yeah, you can't press if you don't make shots.
Exactly. See, you're a quick learner. So I think the key is Gonzaga's a very good defensive team. I mean, a really alert defensive team. I expect Gonzaga to play some zone. But if West Virginia's making shots and getting into the pressure, eventually they're going to have a run. They're not going to turn them over, you know, 20 times. But you know what? Like they did to Notre Dame, a great passing team, a low turnover team. They're going to turn them over 14 times. And those 14 turnovers are going to result in a bunch of points. And they're going to trap Nigel Williams-Goss on every inbound catch in their pressure. Every time he catches the ball, there'll be a hard pressure on him. They'll get the ball out of his hands. They'll force someone else to make a play. And I think that's going to be a concern for Gonzaga. The other area I'm concerned is on the backboards. Part of the pressure of West Virginia is their ability to get to the glass. So I think this is a bad matchup for Gonzaga. And as much as I would love to see Fewey get to the Final Four because he's so good, and I'm tired of people saying, oh, what is Gonzaga been able to do? They've been able to do a lot. He's a great coach, and he's got an incredible program. I do look at this as one of those bad matchups.
All right, so you're going West Virginia.
I'm going West Virginia, and you're going Gonzaga.
All right, Xavier, Arizona. I'm going to pick Arizona. What about you?
Yeah, I'm going to pick Arizona as well. Arizona is basically a bigger, faster, stronger Xavier team. And obviously it's the pupil against the teacher, and that sounds great. Those guys have such an incredible relationship. I like Arizona in the Final Four. I like their depth. I like their front court. I think that you see guys like Comanche improving. Trier changes them because he gives them a slashing scorer. I like Arizona in this game.
I'm going to stick with my original pick. I have Gonzaga of Arizona. Let's go to the Midwest. Kansas taking on Purdue and Oregon, Michigan. These games will be Thursday, Saturday at the Sprint Center in Kansas City. But look, Kansas played in the Big 12 tournament there. They didn't win it, so there's no guarantee. Caleb Swanigan, we're going to talk about him in a moment. Phenomenal.
There was a guy named Jackson that didn't play in that Big 12 tournament. He's pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so who do you have?
Yeah, I think it's going to be this game's going to come down to Andy's pace and speed. The faster the game gets, the better it is for Kansas.
Right.
The slower the game gets, the better it is for Purdue. If ball pressure buys time, so if Kansas can pressure the basketball, if Kansas can get out in transition, if Kansas can put Swanigan and Haas in ball screens, if Kansas can, you know, because you got to say, you got that big lineup? Well, that big lineup's going to have to guard Josh Jackson. So I think he'll go, I think he'll split the bigs, which means Haas might only play 10 minutes in this game because they got to have someone who can deal with Josh Jackson. And I think that's where, you know, the chess match comes. But I think the speed basically overcomes the size of Purdue. And I use Villanova a little bit as my test case, although different. But an undersized team that could pressure the basketball that basically takes Purdue out of its rhythm.
All right, so we're both agreeing on Kansas. Oregon, Michigan. No Chris Boucher in this tournament, obviously, for Oregon out with a knee injury. Michigan, phenomenal games over the weekend. Both were just such a pleasure to watch. Who do you like here?
Who? You know, I love Oregon. I loved Oregon a year ago. I think Boucher hurt out is a real issue because, you know, Boucher is a space guy. What I mean by that is he creates space on the floor for guys to play. Without him, you got to move Brooks to four, which is a great, that's not an issue, and it's actually a matchup problem. But if you want to play bigger, it becomes an issue because you don't have a guy like Boucher who can spot off penetration and knock down threes in the corner. I like just the way Michigan's playing right now. I like the way they're shooting the basketball. I like the way they're defending. I like their length. Nothing with the destiny thing. Michigan is good because they have good players and good system, and they're defending better. And I like Michigan in this game.
I do as well, and I'm going to take Michigan over Kansas. So I'm riding this thing.
Whoa, you and Dan Dockage, D squared and Andy Cash.
I am changing my pick.
Wow, shocking.
Because I had Kansas coming out of this bracket. I'm changing it.
Uh-oh. What was that?
Guys, come on now. Have some fun. It's a record scratch, right?
Oh, is that what it is? I thought I did something. You know me. I'm not technically on it, Josh.
I am changing my pick.
Hey, wait, do that again. That sounds like Katz's voice. Do it one more time. Yeah, that's good. Put a zipper on him.
I am changing my
pick. Wait a second. How can you change? You have a bracket. How can you change a bracket right in the middle of the bracket?
Well, I'm just reseeding it, and I'm going.
You're reseeding it? How do you reseed it? Now Katz loses his voice and makes up his own rules. It's unbelievable. So I believe go on the road a couple days, watch a couple of games. Who'd you say?
I'm going Michigan. What about you?
I'm going to go Kansas. I like the way they're playing. I don't think that I think they're disciplined enough defensively, and I think they'll take a page out of Rick Pitino, take away the three, and I think Landon Lucas is a better one-on-one defender maybe than some of the Louisville kids.
All right, Seth, you know what I'm dubbing the South now? I'm calling it the Blue Blood Bracket. Can you say that?
Oh, boy, that's an original thing right there now. You might be the only one who've named that one. When I think of Andy Katz, I think of Wordsmith. It's amazing they don't let you write.
But here's the thing. I mean, how crazy is it to say that Butler has been to two Final Fours during this time period? So, you know, why not include them in this Blue Bloods at this juncture?
And you know what? They can win that game. I'll use that as a Butler doesn't give up second shots. They don't give up transition baskets, and they don't turn it over. So if you don't turn it over, all right, and you run efficient offense, all of a sudden your defensive transition is in pretty good shape. You're talking about a Carolina team, obviously, that's as good as any team in the country in transition. Carolina leads the country in second chance points. Butler's one of the best defensive rebound teams in the country. Now, defending the post, keeping it out of paint is going to be the challenge. If they defend the post early, Butler, all right, all of a sudden this game changes. And then I like Keelan Martin in this game to put up big numbers. I think he's a guy that can take things over. You know, he's kind of a hit-and-miss player, but I expect him to do something pretty special.
So you're going
Having
Butler.
Said that, I'm taking North Carolina.
Yes,
let me give you one matchup to watch in that game, Andy.
All right.
Baldwin, Barry. Barry was 3-for-2. Huh?
You fooled me. I thought you were going to pick Butler.
Well, maybe I'll change. I can be like you and we can scratch something. Baldwin and Berry. Berry was 3-for-21 from the field this past weekend. He's obviously playing on a little bit of a bum angle. Baldwin is as good a defender on the ball as I've seen in a long time. Well, I watched some film on him this afternoon. He puts great pressure on the ball. And we know when Joel Berry's not good, Carolina's not good. But I'm sticking with Carolina.
All right, so we both have Carolina. All right, UCLA, Kentucky, rematch of the game earlier this season that UCLA won at Rupp. Now, Kentucky won that basketball game Sunday that I saw against Wichita State on two defensive plays. Those last two possessions for Wichita State, great blocks by Monk. Adebayo was right there. So who wins this one?
I think Adebayo was as important at that last possession as any because he realized the time, he realized no second shot, and he stayed in and helped on the jump shooter. And he's a big part of what Kentucky's doing moving forward anyway. But UCLA is an elite offensive team. They've improved defensively. They score more easy baskets. They have more shot makers. Here's a matchup to watch, you know, because I love the matchups to watch. The matchup at the four, TJ Leaf, Derek Willis. If Derek Willis can neutralize TJ Leaf, advantage Kentucky. If not, UCLA wins by six.
So who are you going to pick?
I'm going to pick UCLA. I got him as my national champion.
All right, so do I. So we have UCLA coming out of the West, excuse me, the South. We both agree on that. So let's just review this real quick. Both of us agree with UCLA out of the South. In the Midwest, I have revised my bracket. I'm going with Michigan. You're going with Kansas. We both agree with Wisconsin out of the East. And then I'm keeping Gonzaga in the West, and you are staying with Arizona. Is that correct?
So you're going Gonzaga to make the Final Four.
I am.
Bold move. Bold move.
It is a very bold move. And when we come back here on Courtside a little earlier, had a chance to catch up with Xavier head coach Chris Mack.
They're dancing on the sidelines of the Musketeers. Chris Mack has finally shown a smile on the sidelines. He's going to midcourt. 2 seconds, 1 second, and the Xavier Musketeers will go to the Sweet 16 for the sixth time since 2008.
And that call is courtesy of Westwood One, the NCAA Radio Network. And now joining us here on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line, Xavier head coach Chris Mack. Chris, I love the fact that we were talking about Xavier for weeks as, you know, a team on the bubble. And, you know, we were all doing our own little challenging from outside Xavier. And what did you guys do? You shut us all up. You beat Butler. You go into the NCAA tournament. You knock off Maryland. You knock off Florida State. You're in the Sweet 16. It's a great story. And it just shows how much you guys have persevered. So the question is, how'd you do it?
Well, I just, I think our team, Andy, never really stopped believing. And, you know, through that six-game losing streak, which was tough, you know, there were a couple things that we were dealing with internally. You know, you had Trayvon Blewett missing three of those games. You know, at the same time, we're trying to tutor a freshman point guard in Quentin Gooden, who went from playing 12, 13, 14 minutes a game to now never really having the ball out of his hands and playing the entire game. And so there's a little bit of an adjustment period that you have to make. And, you know, at the same time, we were playing really, really good teams. And, you know, I don't know how many teams can have a six-game losing streak and still be talked about as an NCAA tournament team. And I think that goes to show you the strength of the schedule that we were playing. And, you know, we kept that belief and we kept after it every single day in practice. And I give a lot of credit to our guys for not wilting and being able to step up at the end of the year when they did.
So let's go back first to the Big East tournament. You know, you had knocked off DePaul two times. So you got DePaul that third time. You beat them. Heading into that Butler game, I don't know if you said it to the team, but what were you thinking about what you needed to do to get into the NCAA tournament entering that Butler game?
Well, you know, we didn't really talk about it in terms of, you know, trying to make the NCAA tournament at that point. You know, we just felt like what we needed to do differently against Butler was finish the game. You know, I told our team that,
you know, we had played Butler two times prior to that tournament game. And for the 80 80 minutes that we played, 72 of which you couldn't tell who the better team was. And what I mean by that is, you know, when we were at Butler, it's a tie game with 4 minutes left to go. And when we're at home against Butler, it's a tie game with 4 minutes to go. And we just have to have a belief in ourselves that, you know, in those eight, what's going to be different about the 8 minutes here, you know, in the quarterfinals? What's going to be different? And, you know, our want to needs to be different. Our desire to close the game needs to be different. And if it is, then it'll be meant to be and we'll advance. And, you know, I just felt like that particular night, our guys wanted the game a little bit more. And that's a heck of a thing because Butler, as you know, isn't going to beat themselves.
So when Edmund Sumner went down, at that point, when you know he's done for the year, how much did you really believe this team could flip the switch, reconstitute itself, and be an NCAA tournament team that actually wins games?
Well, number one, we were off to a really good start, you know, for getting there. And, you know, the second part is we played when Edmund went down, there were about 7 minutes left in a game at St. John's in Madison Square Garden where Quentin Gooden, now, do we know that Edmund was gone for the year? No, but we knew he was out for that game. And Quentin really responded. I mean, he played terrific in the last 7 minutes of that game with St. John's pressing, using their athleticism all over the floor. And, you know, we managed to end that game victorious and come away with, you know, a win. And with our freshman point guard, you know, housing or, you know, shouldering all the pressure, you know, that St. John's puts on you. So I felt really good about, you know, our team moving forward. And then a lot of people don't realize, you know, we won the next three games, Andy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, we come back, we end up beating, and I don't know the order, but we beat Seton Hall, we go to Creighton, and then we come back and beat DePaul, you know, with a team, you know, functioning with our freshman point guard. And that's when Trayvon Blewett went down. You know, we play Villanova the very next game, and 6 minutes into the game, Trayvon gets hurt, and it's a close game against Villanova. So at that point, you know, our team became a lot different team because not only now are we without Edmund, we're without Trayvon. And I don't think that got talked about a whole lot, you know. So we were pretty successful right out of the gate when Edmund went down. But when you take your two leading scorers and your two best playmakers
right.
Off the floor, that's when our team, I think, lost a little bit of confidence and, you know, just had to regroup and try to figure out a way to keep the group together, keep believing in one another, not necessarily what the outside world presented to us.
Chris, you guys have been different seeds throughout the course of your career at Xavier. And if I said, you know, Xavier's playing Maryland or Florida State during the regular season at one of these neutral tournaments or something, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise if you knocked those teams off. When you come in as the double-digit seed, though, how much pressure do you think is on that lower seed? And conversely, how much more free do you think the double-digit seed plays with?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Andy. And, I think our guys truly believe that it really doesn't matter what that number says in front of your name. You know, you have to go out and prove it on the floor. But to your point, you know, we were in that situation a year ago. And, you know, when you say how much pressure is there, I think it's how much pressure can you put on the other team? You know, can you get to the last 6-7 minutes of the game and it be a one possession game? And, you know, Wisconsin, you know, they put that pressure on us a year ago and they executed down the stretch. I think we were up 7 points with 5.5 minutes left. And, you know, they kept after it. They kept, you know, kept grinding away. And, you know, for us, it's about making sure that, for instance, the Florida State game obviously wasn't a close game, but if we could take care of the ball and keep them out of transition and keep putting pressure on them to have to score in the half court, eventually you feel like you can crack them if it's a close game coming down the stretch. And, you know, that's got to be our mentality and will continue to be our mentality as long as we're in the tournament.
So you got Arizona next, coached by Sean Miller, obviously
yep.
a very good friend, not just to you, but to the Xavier program. What did he mean to Xavier?
He meant a lot. You know, he meant a lot. I mean, he put Xavier on the map, but he put Xavier in a much different place than it was, you know, prior to him being there. I mean, Sean cared deeply about Xavier. You know, he was on the staff when Thad Mata was here, and you know, Sean took Xavier to its second ever Elite Eight, and just the continual success that he had was tremendous. And, you know, for me, I learned so much under Sean, you know, during my 5 years with him, that I'll be forever grateful. It stinks that I have to play a friend, and we have to play a friend in Sean in the Sweet 16. But as I've said many times before, it beats sitting at home watching these games on the couch.
Obviously, there's a lot of top teams still left. North Carolina, Kentucky, Gonzaga, out west with you guys, Arizona. But Duke and Villanova lose over the weekend. What does that say about this tournament and the state of college basketball?
Well, I mean, I think it says, you know, that there are some competitive programs, competitive players left in the tournament that want to win. And even some of the teams that you talked about advancing, North Carolina, I mean, they didn't do it with a 25-point victory. You know, I mean, they needed everything and more down the stretch against Arkansas. So, again, I think that, you know, these games are highly competitive. Guys know what's at stake. They're playing to win. And I think because of the familiarity that players have through AAU, you know, over the years, I know AAU is much maligned, Andy, but it just, you know, you have a familiarity. I mean, guys play against one another in all these national events from the time they're 12 years old all the way up until the time they enter college. And so there's not that, you know, awestruck feeling that maybe you had when I played years ago. So, you know, it's just it's one of those things that I think keeps attracting viewers and people following, you know, an NCAA tournament in March Madness because of the competitiveness that they watch on television.
Chris, if I told you a month ago that the only two Big East teams that were going to be in the Sweet 16 were going to be Xavier and Butler, what would you have told me?
Well, I'd have signed up for it. And, and honestly, I wouldn't have necessarily been surprised, because in the NCAA tournament, Andy, as you know, anything can happen, you know, on any given night. You don't have to be the best team, you know, throughout the course of the regular season to advance. You have to be better than that particular team for 40 minutes or 45, whatever it takes, whatever it calls for. And, you know, we're very fortunate to be in the position that we are. But when we went down to Orlando, I told our team, it's not going to matter what the other 64 teams do in the NCAA tournament. You know, it's not going to matter. The only thing that matters is when we go down there, it's a four-team, two-game tournament for us. We call it the Orlando Invitational. And we just had to handle it.
I think you're undefeated down there.
Maryland. What's that?
I think you're undefeated down there in that city.
Yeah, I tell you, Orlando's been really good to us. But, you know, all we have to worry about is Maryland. And then if we're lucky enough to advance and fortunate enough to advance, then we got to be lucky enough against Florida Gulf Coast or Florida State, whoever is the victor in that game. And then the next thing you know, you're one of 16 other teams, you know, 15 other teams playing for a national championship, and really proud of our group.
Chris, I've said this many times because you're very public about it, and I love your work-life balance. I really look at you and Mark Few of Gonzaga as probably the two guys that get it the most. Great families, and you just understand life. And not that I'm preaching here, but I love that you are like that and share it with the world here of those that follow you. So with that being said, you know, Mark has done a great job of making Gonzaga his home. Like, he's not going anywhere. And your name gets thrown out all the time, various jobs, Indiana's open, all this. And this happens every year. So why not Xavier as a long-term destination home? Why can't it be that? Or is it?
Well, I think it can be. You know, and I go back to the first part of what you were talking about, Andy. I don't know where I heard it, but, you know, I truly believe it. You know, when I hear work-life balance, you know, I don't necessarily buy into that. You know, I try to intertwine them. You know, I want my kids to be as intimately involved with our program as they can. You know, whether that's going, you know, on road trips with us, as long as they don't miss too much school. You know, whether it's taking my kids to Media Day in New York City for Big East Media Day, which I did earlier in the year, and, you know, taking, you know, Lainey, my oldest, on a recruiting trip during July. To me, I don't want to be the missing dad. That's so much more important than anything else in my life. And I want our players to know that I'm going to give it an unbelievable effort for them. I'm going to try to get them as prepared as I can but I don't want to go missing, you know, for my family. And that's really, really hard in our business. So I try to intertwine them. I don't even believe in, you know, a balance. And, you know, so, you know, when people talk about other jobs, it's very flattering. You know, it speaks to the success that we've had at Xavier. But I've said many times, I feel like I'm a little different, and I think Xavier's a little different in the fact that, you know, we're in a very high-profile conference. You know, we're in a conference that had a team win a national championship a year ago, and that's what we're aspiring to do here. I'm not saying it's easy. You know, we have to get to a Final Four first. But, you know, I really believe in Xavier, and like I've said many times, you know, I'm from here. I went to school here, both in high school, grade school, and college, and so it would have to be something that would be very, very dramatic for me to think about leaving Xavier.
Well, Chris, we appreciate it. Great run to the Sweet 16, and good luck against Arizona.
Thanks, Andy.
So, Seth, the latter part of that interview, as you heard, was me talking about Chris Mack and how basically Xavier, for him, can be a destination job, even though he gets his name thrown out a lot all over the place. And, of course, one of those places is Indiana. So let's first deal with the move since we last talked, the timing of the move by Indiana to fire Tom Crean on the day of the first game. I think it was right off at the beginning of that, you know, on Thursday. What did you make of the timing of Indiana deciding to buy out Tom Crean?
Yeah, I think that I was a little bit surprised, not shocked. Nothing shocks me right now in terms of college basketball. And you know, the guy went to two Sweet 16s. He took a step back this year. They had some injuries. But once you lose momentum in our game, it's hard to regain it. The way they played was hit or miss. And what I mean by that, because they had their bigs handling the ball. They were a high turnover team. They were a team that lacked the defensive identity at times, although they won a ton of games. And that bothered the Indiana fans. That was not Bob Knightian. I mean, Knight's teams were great pass and catch teams. Knight's teams were terrific defensively. Because this team wasn't, they were never, and Tom was never embraced completely by the Indiana faithful. So I was hoping he was going to get out before they could get him. You know, I'm a big Tom Crean fan. I think that he's a very good basketball coach and a good teacher. But, you know, it's always disappointing. And think about his daughter's in school there. His son was supposed to play baseball there. I mean, you talk about impact on family. I mean, this is going to be significant. But, you know, Tom will resurface, I don't know where, at a high level. And he's going to have great success because he's a really good basketball coach.
All right, so there's an assumption out there that it's going to be Steve Alford. He's got a buyout of $7.8 million at UCLA. Of course, everything is negotiable. Indiana's got to pay Tom Crean $4 million. Likely going to have to pay Steve Alford or anyone else $3 million. That's a lot of money for Indiana to pay a buyout, plus a new coach, plus the old coach. Let's deal with Alford first. What do you think the chances are that he's the next head coach at Indiana?
I think he will be. I think it'll play out a little longer than people expect. But, Andy, if someone came to you and said, you know, you got a four-year contract, but you know what? We want you to give 1 year back. All right? What are they telling you? They're telling you they don't want you. They're telling you that they want you on their terms.
Which I agree, but Seth, let me just interject one thing, because you worked in the Cal State system. This is the UC system. I agree with you, but I also would say that there is no way that UCLA is going to walk away with not getting something. They may negotiate down from 7.8, but they're going to get something. No UC school, because that's a horrible precedent. If they walk away from this contract, then what good is a contract going forward?
No, I'm not talking about that, Andy. He's going to have to pay his buyout. He'll probably pay 50%, 50 cents on the dollar. I'm just talking about in general. They basically told him it would be in your best interest to give a year of your contract back, your extension that we gave you last year back. What kind of loyalty should he have to that school? What type of loyalty? You enter a new contract in good faith. All right, you have a rough year, and they're asking you because UCLA at times eats their own. And so when I look at this, I say, here's a school that asked me to return a portion of my contract as opposed to a school that will probably like to build a statue in my honor that will pay me significantly. I just think it's a fit and it's time. And, you know, next year, how good will UCLA be? I don't know. We can talk about how great the recruiting class is. If you're Steve Alford, coaching Lonzo Ball had to have been a blast. But next year, coaching his brother, I'm sure is a great kid also, because obviously the parents know how to raise their children. But why, if Lonzo's brother is not a great player, would you want to deal with that, Dad? Because he doesn't have to deal with him now.
Right.
Because you know what? The kid's the best player on the team. He makes everyone better. He's the center of attention. And, oh, by the way, the kid carries himself with tremendous poise, tremendous character, a great teammate. I mean, great in the locker room. I mean, he really is he's a amazing superstar in the manner in which he carries himself.
All right, but if it's not Alford,
I just think it's going home. I think Steve Alford going home back to UCLA. I mean, back to Indiana.
Hypothetically, yeah. If it's not Alford, who would you pick?
Now, that's interesting. My gut feeling is a guy like Greg Marshall, although they thought that Tom was quirky. You know, Greg is a master coach and teacher, but he's got his own quirks. Staying inside the family, can Fife get the job? Can Whitman get the job? Can Woodson get the job? Would Chris Holtman want the job? They're not getting Brad Stevens.
No.
My outside-the-box candidate.
I don't buy the Billy Donovan either.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's my one outside-the-box candidate. Now, I'm a big Archie Miller fan. But you know what? You're not firing Tom Green to hire Archie Miller. I'm sorry.
But here's the thing. If Billy Donovan left the NBA, first of all, that wouldn't happen until late April, or depending on when the Thunder get eliminated.
Well, if he took the job, it would happen immediately.
Well, if he did that, then he can kiss goodbye ever working in the NBA again.
Well, if you're taking the Indiana job, you're not going back to work in the NBA, Andy.
All right, let's move on to Illinois. Because
I knew you were going to get to that one.
This is bizarre.
No, it isn't.
No, just hear me out, if you can hear me. Number one, I don't fault Illinois for trying to get Brad Underwood. Obviously, he's a good candidate, great coach. Now, you're talking about loyalty here and money, but let me talk to you about loyalty with the coach and the players. Okay, Brad Underwood, one season at Oklahoma State, coaches against Michigan on Friday. Clearly, if not Brad Underwood, his representative, Brett Just, someone was talking to Illinois for this thing to happen so fast. Because he flies back with the team Saturday afternoon. He's the head coach at Illinois. First time he met Josh Whitman, the AD, supposedly, was Saturday morning. And he's now the head coach. So, take it from a couple of different angles, Seth. Number one, the move. Number two, the timing. And number three, where does this leave Oklahoma State?
Well, I mean, here's the move. I mean, I think it's a responsibility for administration to have a relationship with your head coach. There's a fair market value. Now, Brad Underwood took the job as probably the lowest paid coach in the Big 12. All right? And he had success. And, you know, administrator probably says, oh, this kid's the guy's having success. We got a good one here. You go and you try to put your arms around him and lock him up and work with him. Because I think the job of an administrator is to have a relationship with your head coach. Once the head coach administration relationship breaks down, it's hard to heal. And I can speak from experience. So, you know, they signed Brad to this contract. He was trying to renegotiate, or I would have thought they would have tried to renegotiate with him. Things broke down. So once that's put to rest, you have Illinois who comes and approaches his representative. Brad coached his tail off against Michigan. He coached his tail off. I mean, did an incredible job with his team. It doesn't take long, Andy, if column A is offering you $1 million, all right, and is inflexible, and column B is offering you almost $3 million or $2.5 million over 6 years. If you lose, your representative comes to you and says, you know what? Illinois wants you. You're their number one choice. They're going to pay you X amount of dollars. It's real simple. Yes, I want to take the job. No, I don't want to take the job. He flew back with his team. That's what was presented to him. And he decided to accept the job.
All right, let me play devil's
advocate. It's not hard to put your arms around.
What about those that will say now, okay, player wants to leave, and now you're going to block me from leaving? Look what you just did.
Well, first of all, Brad Underwood never blocked anyone from leaving.
No, I'm not saying Brad. I'm saying in general.
So, does that happen? In very, very infrequent circumstances, it happens. And when it does happen, it's usually overturned because of public pressure, number one. All right? Number two is that I think it's a little different. And you're going to see a day where kids can transfer and not sit out. And you'll see free agency in college basketball. But to me, you're talking about I don't even know how old Brad is, probably 45 or 50-year-old guy that's been a basketball lifer, that's coached at every level, all right, that has a chance to change his family's life. And you know what? Sometimes they're adults, and I understand the business aspect of it, but you know what? I think there's more to it than that, because the job of a coach is a leader, the job as an educator. And, yeah, was he disloyal to Oklahoma State who gave him an opportunity? Yeah, he was. But it happens every single day in the real world, every single day. We see fifth-year kids leave without having to sit out, recruited right off their teams. So it's not a one-way street. And when a head coach, that's a person that's earned through years and years of work and sacrifice the opportunity that he received. He wasn't given it. He earned it.
All right. So as we're taping this, Oklahoma State's still open. Cal's still open. LSU's still open. Clemson not open because they've made a statement that Brad Bonnell is staying.
I could have told you that last week.
No, I'm not surprised. There is an opening, though, on the Syracuse staff, because Mike Hopkins is now the new head coach at Washington, yet he was supposed to be the new head coach at Syracuse after next season. This was a stunner. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I think Jim Boeheim wanted to continue to coach. I'm not going to put words in anyone's mouth, but I think what happened, potentially could have happened, is Jim and John Wildhack sat down and said, John said, Jim, we'd love for you to stay a couple more years. They agreed upon that, which obviously Mike Hopkins looked at and said, well, I'd be 50 by then. If I can get an opportunity to become a head coach, maybe that's in my best interest. That could have happened. I'm not saying it did happen. Or Washington is a really good job. And for an assistant coach to get a job at that level.
Yeah, it's really good.
Is phenomenal. That's usually a job that a proven head coach gets. It's closer to his home in Southern California. And I think that Mike said, you know what? This is a place I could build in my own image. I don't have to follow Coach Boeheim, my mentor. I can learn my trade without being compared every single day to a guy that has 1,000 wins. So I think it's great for Mike. It's great for Adrian Autry, who's going to become the associate head coach. I think they will find another, Jay Mack will still be there. I think they will find another Syracuse guy in the family to join them. And now what they got to do, if it's true that Tyler Lydon has put his name in and signing a contract, they got to go get some players. They got to get some dudes, and they'll probably enter that fifth-year market again. And they'll, try to rebuild and move forward. And I think great opportunity for Hop, great opportunity, big picture for maybe Adrian Autry down the line. But they're not going to hire a coach in waiting.
No.
Because a coach in waiting it rarely works, in my opinion.
Well, you know what it does? It gets more Jim Boeheim time on our podcast. That's what I like.
Yeah, well,
you got him again today. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know he joined us.
Yeah, well, good coach, a couple more years. I can get more wins.
All right, well, that'll wrap up this edition of Courtside with Cats and Coach G. As always, you can follow Seth on Twitter, at Seth on Hoops. You can follow me on Twitter, at ESPN 80 Cats. We want you to find our podcast on the ESPN app. Click on that headphone icon. And, of course, subscribe to us all over the place where you can find a podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Courtside with Cats and Coach G. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app or download and listen on Apple Podcasts. Courtside with Cats and Coach G.